It's time now for hour number two of this weekend's big two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here's the host of the program, Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts in upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism, speaking with Douglas Perry, an award-winning writer and the author of Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero, published by Viking.
Now, I want to start out by asking you about the year 1957, when a former federal law enforcement agent published a book called The Untouchable, and that's really how Elliot Ness became a household name. So how popular was the book, and what other media exposure did he get that really made him so well known?
Oh, the book was a huge bestseller, particularly after the TV series that came along a couple years later. Ness, of course, died prior to the publication of the book, and he did not write the book. He was not happy with the memoir, The Untouchables. He felt it was inaccurate, which is true, it was inaccurate. And he had considered pulling the plug on it, and then he died before he made a decision on what to do, and the ghostwriter, Oscar Fraley, went ahead and published it as is.
Well, it's certainly filled with wild accounts of his battles with Al Capone. Now, why did Elliot Ness and his group of agents get dubbed the Untouchables in the first place?
The reason is that prior to the Untouchables, they were officially called the Capone Squad. Capone and his gang pretty much had free rein in Chicago because they spent upwards of $1 million every month, and this is in early 1930s dollars.
Wow.
On bribes. They bribed Chicago police, judges, Prohibition Bureau agents, and they had the run of the town because of that. Elliot Ness and his team were charged with harassing the bootlegging operation and squeezing Capone's income, and most of them resisted bribery. Ness in particular was absolutely incorruptible. There were a few members of the team who did accept bribes, and Ness stayed on top of that and was able to push them out. But that's something that no one knew about until I found it in the research for this book.
The book really shows a lot of interesting research that you did. Now, how old was Elliot Ness when he became a Prohibition agent, and he was appointed to go after the Capone gang? And how old was Capone?
They were both surprisingly young.
Amazes me.
Joined the Prohibition Bureau right out of a year out of college. He was 28 years old when the Untouchable Squad was formed. Capone was only a couple of years older than that. It's hard to believe that Capone had such a huge empire, and he was barely 30 years old.
Now, let's talk about the work he did in raiding Capone's hidden breweries in 1931. Was it a dangerous job, and what kind of impact did he really have on Capone's operations?
It was certainly a dangerous job, absolutely. He and his men risked their lives every single day going after Capone and his men, who were, violent. They were murderers. You see the results in the wiretaps that Ness and his team set up. That was the first thing they did when they got rolling. They put in wiretaps at every known Capone haunt. And in the first couple of weeks, you hear, men who are absolutely confident that they can go and do whatever they want, whenever they want. And within a few weeks, that all changed. Suddenly, these men who are, they're not willing to go to meetings, and they're not willing to go and, fetch an extra barrel of booze to deliver to such and such place. They become very circumspect and careful and touchy. It's interesting that just a few weeks after they started raiding some of the breweries, a member of Capone's gang saw one of Ness's men out on the street. He walked over to him. He said, "People in this town get along great. So what's your problem?" And he meant it because he didn't understand. You know, for years, the Capone gang had free reign. And so suddenly, why was this all changing? They were befuddled for quite a while.
Now, when it actually came to prosecuting Capone, Elliot Ness and his crew, they put together a 5,000-count bootlegging indictment, but the U.S. attorney in Chicago decided to prosecute him on tax evasion charges. So why was that, and how many tax evasion charges was he actually found guilty of? Because he didn't serve a heck of a lot of time, I don't think, in prison.
Right. It was a handful of charges that he was convicted of. The reason that the U.S. attorney chose to pursue the tax case is, one, it was a strong case, as was the prohibition case. He felt that he wouldn't be able to find a jury that was willing to convict anyone of prohibition charges. Prohibition, remember, was hugely unpopular, whereas nobody liked tax cheats. Everyone had to pay their taxes. They may not have liked it, but they had to pay them, and they were not happy when someone like Al Capone, who was a multimillionaire, was able to get away with not paying his taxes. And besides, this was the early days of the Great Depression. The government needed every cent it could for, relief efforts. And so there was just a much greater chance in terms of the psychology of the jurors in terms of getting a conviction with the tax charges. And Capone, he didn't spend too long in prison when you consider all the things that he did. But in terms of a conviction for tax evasion, that's about, the normal amount. And at the same time, he was paroled in part because his mind had gone because of advanced syphilis. And so the authorities knew that he was not going to return to his criminal activities. He could barely function at all when he left prison.
Now, I want to tell you what I found so fascinating about your book. And that's the fact that it talks about Ness's crime-fighting career post-Chicago, because he wasn't even 32, and he became director of public safety in Cleveland. And boy, was he ahead of his time when he came to law enforcement. So he started something that's in every police department now. They have an internal affairs department. And so what was so unique about what he did?
That's right. I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, Ness is famous for the Untouchables, but that was early in his career, and it was far from the highlight. In 1935, he became the safety director in Cleveland, which is then the sixth largest city in the country, nearly a million people there. It was terribly corrupt. The police department was owned by the mob, and Ness came in there, and he hired a bunch of secret investigators. They later became known as the Unknowns. They were officially hired as city parking lot attendants, city janitors, that kind of thing. Because as you mentioned, this is prior to police departments having internal affairs divisions. And so these investigators, led by Ness, who went out, on the streets himself, investigated corrupt cops. Within 18 months, they had convicted nearly a dozen officers. Justice was much swifter then than it is now. And that led to a major exodus of corrupt officers, and Ness really turned over that department quickly and effectively. And he was a great innovator. I don't think it's hyperbole to say he was one of the most influential lawmen of the 20th century. He was a huge proponent of what was then called scientific policing, ballistics, things like soil samples, lie detector tests, other lab work. This was before even the FBI lab existed. He really pushed this stuff and other innovations like crime prevention programs, which was a radical idea at the time. He really showed other large cities, what a modern police force should be. And
he thought so much out of the box. He painted his squad cars in a particular way, and he equipped them in a particular way, really, that hadn't been done before. So what did he do, and was it effective?
That's right. It was effective. He didn't have the manpower any longer because of Depression-era budget cuts to have police walking the beats in every neighborhood. And so he started putting officers into squad cars. The city couldn't afford to buy a fleet, and so Ness had to lease them. And it was just 32 cars originally. And so he painted them this kind of gaudy tricolor scheme. The officers hated it. They thought it made it look like they were in clown cars. But the purpose is that when you saw one of these cars, because of the color of them, you remember them. And so people out in the street going about their business, you'd see one of those cars and you felt like you were seeing them all the time because you remembered it. And so it just, it fostered the impression out in the neighborhoods that the police were everywhere, that they were really getting around the town. And so that was very effective.
And he also had these two-way radios, and that was certainly something that police cars didn't have at the time.
Right, that was new, too. His department wasn't the first to do that, but it was one of the first. He really viewed the radio room as he called it the nerve center of the police department. And if you think about it, it made a huge difference. You don't have police officers having to, you know, see a crime and they have to run a couple of blocks to a Murphy call box and call it in. This allowed police to respond much faster, and it made things much more effective for the police in terms of getting their job done. And sure enough, the crime rate in Cleveland fell dramatically during Ness's tenure there. And again, this during the Depression in most major cities, their crime rate was spiking during this period.
Now, after he was director of public safety for Cleveland, it seemed that Elliot Ness's life just started on a downward spiral that never ended. What happened to him? He died at such a young age, 55, from a massive heart attack.
Right. Yes, it did start to go downhill on him. He had trouble in his marriages. He was married three times, and he did cheat on his wives. He battled depression through most of his life. That was just inherent in him. You know, back then they didn't really understand depression. He didn't really know why he was, you know, constantly fighting the blues. This led him to womanizing. This led him to start drinking. By the 1940s, he was drinking rather heavily, and it became a problem for him. After the war, he moved into corporate jobs. He adopted a son, decided it was time to make some real money. But, you know, the alcoholism started to take hold, and he was really having trouble there. And that's why he agreed to do the memoir. He needed the money.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, yes, he died at 55 of a massive heart attack.
That's Douglas Perry in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero, published by Viking. A Touch of Grey continues in just a moment.
A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is our host, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Patricia Corey. She's a best-selling author and founder of the nonprofit Save Earth's Oceans. She's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled The Emissary, published by North Atlantic Books.
Your book is about the plight of the dolphins and whales, but before we discuss this important issue, let's talk about your work with these mammals. Swimming with dolphins in the open oceans and clocking many hours out on the sea with the whales, What have you personally learned from your interaction with him that most surprised you?
I would have to say the enormous consciousness that they demonstrate openly when you're with them. They are very curious about human beings and very playful, if they're in the mood, of course, because when I swim with them, they're absolutely wild. So anything in a tank, I don't even consider swimming or being near these animals. But I would have to say their incredible consciousness, their curiosity, and their music. That's what fascinates me, their music.
And also what you write about in your book is about whales and dolphins finding themselves beached and then dying on shore, and certainly a timing and distressing subject as these kinds of events have been widely reported in the news. Didn't you have a life-changing experience with whales and dolphins in 2008 in Jordan that became the motivation really for your writing this novel?
Well, it was the motivation for the novel before this, which was called Before We Leave You, and that is, the situation was that I was teaching a class in Jordan, a workshop, and in the middle of the workshop, I started to hear whales, I knew that it was dolphins and whales, and they were calling out. I heard first I heard the sound of the actual music, and then I heard voices saying, please help us, please, please help us. And I was catapulted, psychically of course, into a scene where I was in the deep ocean with in the ocean with these whales and dolphins, and they were struggling, and it was a very tragic scene, so much so that in the middle of conducting the class, I had to excuse myself and walk out of the room, and I was crying and trying to get a grasp of what was happening to me. And when I went back to the hotel that night, the news was that 100 whales and dolphins together had beached themselves in New Zealand. And this was shocking because it worked out to be the exact same time that I was picking up that message. This continued to happen to me several times. And I always heard the message, please help us, please help us, please help us. And even my husband said, you know, I wish you didn't have this to do. It just seems like it's gripping you so deeply. And I said, well, it looks like it's my mission. So, yes, I've been very affected by them. And that cry I felt was to me to help get their message out to the human race.
Now, in New Zealand, that's where, in your novel, the whales and dolphins are dying. We meet the courageous heroine of your novel, psychic researcher and telepath, Jamie Hastings, and she witnesses these bone-chilling events, and she says she doesn't know what happened, but she's not going to let it happen again. So, Patricia, how close is Jamie's character to the real you?
I would have to say, in some ways, very close. She's a psychic, and so am I, and she's determined to, after the experience she has of seeing these whales die on the beach, she's determined that she's going to open an association to save the whales. And in fact, in 2012, I opened my own foundation called Save Earth Oceans, Inc. So there is a lot of me in her character. Of course, it's ingrandized because it's quite an extraordinary journey she's on, and adventure, and
it's a thriller.
Yeah, I think that she's inspired by a lot of my life.
I wanted to talk about the fact that it's thought by a lot of people that the marine animals have so many problems due to underwater sonar that the sounds really upset their whole system, that they generate this slow rolling sound, but the waves really generate more decibels than the loudest rock band. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, yes. For starters, imagine, we know how powerful it is when we listen to things underwater, how much faster the sound travels, right?
Right.
So that in itself is an indication of how loud and powerful it is. Plus, they perceive sound as pressure in their cranial audio cavity in their heads. So they're receiving it not only as sound, but as this immense pressure. Now, you take the sonar blasts, which are anywhere from 300 decibels up. The military is shooting enormous sonar blasts through the ocean, and that we're finding whales and dolphins that are washed ashore with their heads blown open.
Wow.
Just blown apart. Their brains are blown apart because the pressure is so intense that it actually blows their heads open. And this is happening on our planet.
Now, with your 501c charity, Save Earth's Oceans, which you've dedicated to waking people up about the urgency for all of us to restore our fragile ocean's ecosystem and save the magnificent, intelligent whales and dolphins, how can people get in touch with you, and do you have any specific ideas for saving our oceans and mammals?
Yeah, we are a new foundation, and so my first big event is coming up in London. It's called Singing the Oceans Alive. It's a fundraising concert dedicated to bringing to the attention of the greater public the importance of the music of the whales and dolphins. There's more to their sounds than mating calls or hunting signals, as we've been told until now. You only have to imagine that one humpback whale call can reach 1,000 miles away. And my fellow researchers have said that they have a sort of relay system where the humpback whale will send out a pattern of sound. 1,000 miles away, the humpback whale that hears that can repeat them and send them another 1,000. So it would appear that they have some sort of global relay system with their sound for purposes that I'd love to think may have very well to do with keeping the oceans in balance, because we know how important sound is, how important energy and frequencies are.
Absolutely.
So isn't it exciting to consider that perhaps the whales have a much bigger purpose, and that their sounds have something to do with holding the Earth's emotional body, which is the water, in balance?
That's Patricia Corey in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled The Emissary. It's published by North Atlantic Books. If you want more information, go to patriciacorey.com. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're going to be joined the rest of the way during this second hour of our broadcast by our senior correspondent, a man of many, many areas of knowledge, Richard Neer, who will just a few minutes from now be talking with legendary quarterback Kurt Warner, Super Bowl winner, two-time NFL MVP and NFL Network analyst. And he has launched First and Goal, a national cholesterol awareness campaign to help people prioritize heart health. And, Richard, you already have conducted this interview, which will have its world debut on this program in just a few minutes. Did you ever know Kurt Warner before that? Is he as nice a guy as he seems to be watching him on TV?
I'll tell you, he seems to be. That's the thing. We've met, you and I, over our lives and careers, many celebrities. And, you know, you always take that little snapshot you have of them during an interview as to be what they really are. Mm. And a lot of times you find out later on that they were being nice to you, and maybe they're not so nice, really. Or maybe they were not being nice to you, and they're really great guys or women. So you never know.
Kurt Warner just seems to be a good guy. I mean, he's got a great story, you know. You know how they say he was stocking shelves in a grocery store one year and playing in the Super Bowl the next? And is there truth to all that? Did he really have a meteoric rise from the pits of obscurity in football?
Absolutely. We get into that in the interview, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And I find it funny to hear the expression meteoric rise because, as you know, meteors fall.
But they fall quickly. The meteoric, yes. Actually, they fly quickly. How about Roman candle? That's a better one. That goes up, it blows
fireworks
up, and it's gone. But Kurt, one more thing about Kurt Warner. Do you think he gets enough credit in the general conversation about quarterbacks and about football players, in spite of his credentials are so impressive? You never really hear people talk about Kurt Warner the same way they'll talk about Dan Marino or the current, Peyton Manning and Drew Brees and of course, Tom Brady. Why is that? Or is that just my warped perception?
Well, I think it has to do with meteoric. He came very quickly. He did not have a very long career because he was fairly advanced in age when he got there. He wasn't one of these 21 or 22-year-old phenom quarterbacks just out of college. He did have a life before that. As he got older in his career, it was a lot shorter than Dan Marino or Joe Montana or any of the real greats.
But he does have a good career now as an analyst, and he seems to be getting better and better at it. I think he's going to be around a long time if he chooses to be as a media figure.
Oh, he's just one of those guys that it seems everything he does is very good. He seems to be, as you say, a very solid person with good values and everything else, and it shows in his work.
I was wondering, Richard, when you see an athlete like Kurt Warner or others that have been in the spotlight, taking on causes with health or something of that nature. What's behind that? Is this are they sought after and paid to do this? Is this something from their heart? Is this a trend? What do you think?
I think it's a combination. I think a lot of them are sought after and paid because, well, let's face it, you have a chance to talk to a Hall of Famer or someone like Kurt Warner. Most people would gladly do it, and they bring up the cause or the issue that they're involved with. So I think a lot of times they are compensated. Some of them donate the money back to a charity or donate that back to a cause. Some of them, because of their careers and having gone through their money, they actually need the money and do this, so that they can sustain themselves.
Interesting. Athletes make so much money these days. You think back to, the stories of the athletes who everything was taken from them by corrupt managers and...
Still happens.
Wow, that's amazing when you think about it in today's world that these folks don't protect themselves with... the people they protect themselves with are the ones sometimes that take advantage of them. We know Mike Tyson was broke, and he made millions. How about the old story of the great boxing legend Joe Louis? Remember that he wound up with penniless, and he had to take a job as a greeter at a hotel in Las Vegas. So you'd come to the hotel, and Joe Louis would be standing there shaking your hand, welcoming you. You've heard that story, I bet.
Oh, sure. Well, that's probably before the time when autographs were so lucrative. Now, if you are a former athlete of some fame, you can make tons of money on the autograph circuit.
Is it true that athletes dislike signing autographs for free when kids come up to them and go, "Can I have an autograph, sir?"
Well, some do, but the other thing is when they sign them for free, a lot of times these kids are being sent by adults to get autographs so that they can sell them. So if a kid wants it to his name, send it to little Jimmy, they say, okay, that's okay because that's not going to have that much value. But if they say, don't put my name on it, just sign it, then it's a sure tip off they're going to sell it.
And an autograph that's to a specific person has less value than just the signature.
Unless your name is Chumley.
That's right, Bob Dylan, Chumley. You fool. All right, well, we are looking forward to the conversation with Kurt Warner coming up next, and the First and Goal Heart Health organization, and a little bit of information about heart health, which is one of the core issues of this program, A Touch of Gray. And then Richard will return with some more conversation about the Donald Sterling Los Angeles Clippers brouhaha that has the whole nation abuzz. So that and more coming your way when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
It's Practical Polly Radio. I've switched to cooking with healthier oils. So now what do I do with all these tubs of lard? Skinny jeans feeling too tight? A bit of lard on your hips and thighs and those pants slide on like a dream. So
there's no need for that lard to go to waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and as promised, here's our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Kurt Warner. He's a Super Bowl winner and a two-time NFL MVP and NFL Network analyst, and he's launched First and Goal, a national cholesterol awareness campaign to help people prioritize heart health.
Kurt, first of all, thanks for joining us, and tell us how you first found out that you had high cholesterol.
Well, it is amazing. You mentioned that there are 71 million Americans deal with high cholesterol, and I was diagnosed right in the middle of my NFL career, and I thought for sure it couldn't hit me. I wouldn't be one of that 71 million because I'm in great shape. I have a pretty good diet, young enough that it can't affect me. And, you know, I found out that I had high cholesterol. You know, took the approach that, okay, I'll knock this out myself. Continue to exercise. I'll modify my diet a little bit more, and we'll be able to take care of this. And I would just come back year after year for my physicals and see that the cholesterol was still high, and it was still high. And it was at that point where I sat down with my doc and said, okay, we've got to come up with a better game plan. This isn't working for me. Is it possible that diet and exercise would not be able to take care of this itself? And he told me that for most people, a statin is needed along with diet and exercise to take care of this problem. And so that's really why I'm here, is that I'm like, I think, so many people out there that say, oh, I'm too young or I'm in too good a shape. This can't be a problem for me. And so we've designed a great website. It's called firstandgoalhearthealth.com, which really helps take people through, you know, four easy steps to getting their heart health under control.
Now, Kurt, when you found this out, I guess a lot of times the first reaction is, why me? I mean, you were in great shape, obviously an NFL player. Did they tell you anything about, was it genetic? Was it just the lifestyle prior to this? Or what caused this to happen to you?
Well, that's what I did find out, is that a big piece of this is hereditary. It is that, you know, it's going to be passed down from one generation to the next. And that's why diet and exercise alone doesn't help most people. And so statins have been introduced to really help people get those levels under control. And something else that I realized in the process is that not all statins are the same. I think when you're not a doctor, you kind of think, okay, all those medications do the same thing, so put me on one. And I was put on my first statin and had some side effects, had some muscle aches and pains, which is a common side effect for statins. And so I had to go back to my doctor and go, okay, this doesn't seem to be working, and, you know, I still want to take care of this. And so he was able to share different options with me from that point. And now I'm on the newest statin, which is Livelo, which is actually metabolized a little bit different, which can help avoid a lot of those drug interactions or side effects that we have. And so I think that's the key, is sit down with your doctor and develop that game plan, all-inclusive, diet, exercise, the right medication, and keep him updated on what's going on. And, again, that's what our website does, is it takes you through that process, makes sure that you take and check off each of the boxes of all the steps that you need to take, because, heart disease is one of the biggest killers in our country. And we just mentioned 71 million people deal with this. And, you know, so many people take the approach, well, I'm young, you know, I'm in shape, I don't have to worry about this. And I'm a firm believer, this is one of those things you need to take care of sooner rather than later.
Well, Kurt, and you just brought up a great point, because anecdotally, my brother was diagnosed with high cholesterol, as I have been, and he tried the statins for a while, and he had muscle aches, he had all kinds of problems, and he just stopped it. And I understand that after a year, a lot of people do that, 75%. So I think the message is really important to let you know that not all statins are the same, and that those that give you those problems are in a minority, and you can try something else.
That's exactly it, and you find that out a lot. If somebody takes something, thinks they're all the same, and then just quits taking their medication and never really informs their doctor. It's just, oh, this is causing me pain, I'm not going to take that anymore. And that's the message, is, okay, if that one doesn't work for you, go back and talk to your doctor and see what else is available. And that's what I love so much about this, the newest drug, the newest statin, Livelo, is that it takes that different pathway. And so there's a great opportunity for some of those interactions to be avoided. And, you know, that's the great thing is the doctors have the information. We're not all doctors. We don't all know what's out there. So to sit down, huddle up with your doctor, and figure out that perfect game plan for you.
Before we let you go, Kurt, let me ask you a football question that has come to light in the offseason, most recently with DeSean Jackson, some of the allegations, some of the so-called ties, the fact that he was cut by the Philadelphia Eagles. And we know about the Aaron Hernandez story. I'm sure you're very familiar with that. How serious a problem is, A, bullying in the NFL? Did you experience any of that, or did you see any of that? And, B, about the culture there, where it seems that a lot of guys who come perhaps from disadvantaged situations do have kind of unsavory ties. Talk a little bit about that, if you will.
Well, I think the biggest thing is not to make, you know, generalizations about the NFL as a whole. I think every situation is different. You know, what we saw down in the Miami locker room is completely different than anything I experienced. Now, was there some, you know, fun banter or what people might call teasing in the locker room? Sure. You just like brothers and sisters kind of banter back and forth, but always good-hearted and always with the understanding that you had to keep a pulse on what was being said. You know, the situation with Aaron Hernandez, and, you know, I don't want to necessarily say that's the same as DeSean Jackson, but I think all those situations are individual, and you have to monitor those things, and you have to stay on top of them and really know what goes into it, because, you know, there can be positives and negatives. Unfortunately, over the last few years, we've seen some negatives in both of those situations, but I don't think we can automatically say, oh, well, that situation in Miami is like every locker room. But what happened with Aaron Hernandez is the same for all other players. So we have to be very careful not to generalize, you know, the NFL or players as a whole.
Are you hopeful that the concussion situation in the NFL will get a lot better and that parents will not be as frightened as they seem to be now to let their kids play football?
No question. I mean, we know all the benefits and the great things that can come from the game of football, but we also understand the risks that are there. And that's one of my goals moving forward is to try to do whatever I can to educate parents, to educate coaches, to educate players, and to do whatever we can to create new and supplemental padding and ways to help protect players. You know, we know that risk is there, but the game, you know, is so advantageous to so many people. So we have to find that right mix so parents feel more comfortable, so players feel more comfortable when they go out on the football field.
And finally, Kurt, give us that information again on the First and Goal program, the website.
I will. The website is firstandgoalhearthealth.com. A lot of great tools there, even a savings card on there for those of you out there that say, well, I'm not going to be able to afford this medication. A savings card on there to help make it more affordable, because we believe this is a really, really important issue, and that everybody that's dealing with high cholesterol, those 71 million people, all need to get it checked out and get on the right medication.
That's Kurt Warner. Very interesting, as promised by Richard Neer, who conducted that interview. And if you want more information, you can go to the website firstandgoalhearthealth.com. That's firstandgoalhearthealth.com. Richard Neer will be back in a moment to talk a little bit about the Donald Sterling Los Angeles Clippers brouhaha that has everybody across the nation, you know, buzzing. Certainly an interesting story. And before that, though, I'd like to tell you that if you want information about Carol Marks and her adventures, a lot of resources that we have put together for you to make life better, or to listen to some of the best programs in the long history of A Touch of Gray, including some of our most informative interviews, go to the website atouchofgray.com. It's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. And we certainly would love to have you join us there. That's atouchofgray.com. As I said, Richard Neer returns. Oh, by the way, let me point out something. Richard Neer, as I've mentioned, is a man of many, many disciplines and lots of knowledge. In addition to being a sports talk show host, a generalist, and an upper demographic expert, he also is an expert on literature and has a program on podjockey.com on the internet, podjockey.com, called Richard Neer's Novelist Cafe, in which he talks to some of the leading novelists in the world. That's at podjockey.com, Richard Neer's Novelist Cafe. Program continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with The Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we are rejoined, as promised, for the rest of the way here in the final segment of our two-hour get-together by Richard Neer, our senior correspondent. Richard Neer is also a sports talk show host in New York City, has been for more than two decades, and is close to an expert on being an expert on sports as one could find. So this story with Donald Sterling and the Clippers just keeps rolling along, and it's way beyond sports talk. And it has all the elements of a great story. It's got race, it's got sex, it's got money, it's got sports, it's got greed, it's got it all, doesn't it? Great story.
It sure does, and it's got age, which we talk about on this show. Here is an 80-year-old man with a 31-year-old woman.
Now, do you think that 80-year-old millionaire men who have these young babes on their arms, do you think that they believe that they are attracting these women for reasons other than their money?
I think in Donald Sterling's case, if you get his quotes, I think not. I think he kind of understands that it is a business transaction. He gets something from her, she gets something from him, and even in the tape that was released, he said, you know, I get the girl to do what I want, and if she doesn't do it, I get another girl. So it seems to be pretty much hard and cold, take the money.
Don't you love it? I mean, not only is he a racist, he's a sexist. As a matter of fact, I think that he's more of a sexist than a racist.
Well, in many ways.
If you look at it.
But she is not absolved in this situation either. I'm wondering if the California authorities, if she doesn't have some kind of written approval that he allowed her to tape these conversations. It is against the law in that state and many others.
Well, that's a whole other issue that drives me crazy. I'm into privacy. I'm into privacy. I think privacy is a I'm not that worried about Magic Johnson's opportunities in the marketplace. You know, I mean, it's obviously racism and race relations and how we treat people of other ethnicities, whatever our ethnicity is or gender or age. These are all of obvious concern. But privacy, that is something that is so much deeper than these other topics that we don't talk about. And we're all losing our privacy as we, you know, hurl ourselves into this digital age, you know, without any control of where we're going.
Well, it's the camera phone's fault, isn't it, for starters, because now it used to be you had to have a camera and you had to take a picture of somebody and you had to kind of premeditate it. Now you see something, you flip your phone on and you've got a tape of it. You've got video of it.
Yeah. I live my life today as if I'm always on camera. In other words, I never assume that there's not a camera watching me. And that's kind of a weird feeling, isn't it? No matter where you are. But look at the Boston bombing. And in that case, of course, it helped law enforcement find the bombers. But there was something fascinating about how every person within miles of that heinous happening was being, you know, surveillanced, if there's such a word. And it goes on all the time. You're always being watched. So watch where you scratch, you know. It's not so much that you're engaging in illegal or secret activity. It's just personal activity that you never know who's watching you.
Well, that's why the fear of the government, I think, is heightened now, because we all do things that we don't want to be public, whether they're innocent, stupid things that make us embarrassed, mm-hmm. or they're things that are legitimately wrong, or illegitimate, I should say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the government gets a hold of those things and decides to selectively prosecute, we're all in trouble.
Big, big issue. Richard, thank you for joining us. Thank you, of course, to Steve Wiseman, and thanks to Kevin Casey and to the entire Touch of Grey team, Beverly Santinella on the front line producing the program, and, of course, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another big 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.